Hi, everyone out there in the Blog Talk sphere. Welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and coach at the Couple Center and Couple Speak in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I broadcast live, usually on alternate Wednesdays, now at the early bird time of 8:30 p.m. Tonight's episode, March 7th, 2012, is all about compassion, unity, fairness, and fun, and how they play out in marriage and close partnerships. And I'm going to be sharing some ideas, and our guests will hopefully be sharing some ideas for how to create a better dynamic balance of these factors. My co-host tonight is you, the listener. So we'll have an open mic episode, which means that anyone who calls in can stay on the air and be part of the conversation throughout the show. Before we begin, one brief technical issue. Your toll-free call-in number is 877-497-9046 in case you get disconnected and can't find the redial button on your phone, in case you have ADD and you're not really sure where you're at. Anyway, that's your number. All callers will be muted unless you have a question or a comment, in which case press the 1 key to be in line to join me on the air where you can remain for the duration of the show. So that way, if you don't want to be on the air live, you won't be, but if you want to join us, you're welcome to join us. And we already have, looks like we already have one caller, and let me say hi. We have a caller with a 917 area code. Hi, caller. What's your name?
Laura.
Laura. That's great. Welcome to the show. I'm happy for you to join me. And hopefully you can stay on if you choose to. Okay? I'll be asking you a little bit more about your circumstances and anything that you feel like you're needing tonight. We have somebody else who looks like they're from a 772. Hello, caller.
Hi.
Hi, caller. What's your name?
Marge.
Marge, welcome to the show. I'm glad you could also join me. I also have another caller on the air. And as you may have heard, I'm going to have an open mic session tonight, which means that if, you know, obviously you wanted to join me, you're here on the air. So I would love to have a conversation about this. It's kind of boring for me if I'm just talking into the blogosphere by myself. In any event, I just wanted to let our listeners know that this show is about these four attitudes or stances in relationships. It's compassion, unity, fairness, and fun. And I picked these four attitudes or stances to discuss because in my work as a therapist and as a coach and in my personal life, and I'm sure the two of you have experienced this, I find that they are kind of like pillars. They're foundational pillars in good relationships. They're kind of like cement. They're bonding agents. I think they build trust. They deepen goodwill. And I think they also create a kind of bridge between individuality and the we, the I and the we in a relationship. And just for our listeners' purposes, before we get into a conversation, I want to use the dictionary definition that I got for compassion, the first one. It's defined as a deep awareness of the suffering of another, coupled with a wish to relieve it. It's also it's also framed as empathy, pity, tenderheartedness. And I'm wondering, how do the two of you think of compassion, and how do you see it as playing out in your relationship?
Hello, Susan. Hi. It's Laura.
Yeah.
And I'm a practicing Buddhist, and I believe in almost all relationships. It's the base for all relationships. That's a lot of the Buddhist practice, you know, mm-hmm. the Buddhist teachings. But without compassion, I don't think a lot of other things can exist. It's really the foundation for so many relationships in life with with those that you're intimate with, and with all human beings. That's just my feeling.
Okay.
So I think compassion has to play out in all relationships.
Yeah.
I concur.
You concur. You agree with that. And you know what occurred to me as I was thinking about this show, that also self-compassion is really important in a relationship. I hadn't thought of that when I was designing the show, but I think it's really important to be compassionate toward yourself in all relationships.
I wanted to ask you, Susan, do you feel that one, because many people suffer from not having good feelings about themselves, not feeling that they're worthy of love or receiving love. Do you feel that a person can be compassionate to others if they don't necessarily feel that or practice it on themselves?
I would think that it would be very hard. I think it starts with self-compassion. I think sometimes the road goes the other way, though. I think sometimes people have an infinite capacity for compassion toward others, and they're not so nice to themselves. But I think my attitude is that we're all works in progress, and so I'm very hesitant to say no, it can, or yes, it has to be this way or that, because I see people as ever growing and relationships as growing people. And I'm wondering, Marge, what do you think about that? Do you think it's possible to be compassionate?
Absolutely. I believe that we're very hard on ourselves, and having empathy for oneself is probably something that you learn during the course of your lifetime, learning to forgive yourself, learning not to be so hard on yourself. I think that you can pass that on to others, even though you may be hesitant to give it to yourself.
Do you think that giving it to other people ultimately helps you learn to give it to yourself?
I never thought about that, but I'll have to think on that, Susan.
Okay. It's such an important thing, though. In relationships, I see it as when I work with the whole issue of violations a lot in my work, people who either in very extreme ways through a very blatant, long-standing affair, or people who are just highly disrespectful, or people who are verbally or physically abusive. So the whole issue in my practice of forgiveness comes up all the time. And I see compassion, the capacity to have compassion, as really essential in being able to forgive somebody. Because when you think about it, how can you forgive somebody if you demonize them? If you don't have compassion for them and you don't kind of walk in their shoes, how can you... sort of humanize them and ultimately forgive them. So I see it as an important building block toward repair in relationships, not just as an ongoing, open-hearted, important spiritual place to be, but also important in the repair cycle around transgressions.
I think you can have empathy towards another person, even though you may not have walked in their shoes.
Well, I don't mean literally walking in their shoes, but...
I know what you mean.
Yeah. it's really kind of figuratively seeing things from their point of view and having a feeling of empathy for them as a result. It really is a way of not judging people, trying not to judge people. So if you have a friend who's acting like a jerk and who's not being very nice, you could move into a very judgmental stance. Maybe you don't have a life that's at all like theirs, but my experience is that it's really an attempt compassion, in order to feel, you know, compassion, you, it's important for you to try to put yourself into, to kind of walk a mile in their moccasins. I don't know who invented that saying, probably Native Americans, but that I would, you know, it seems to me that in my work, that feels like a very necessary component. Now, Marge, are you saying that you can feel compassion for somebody without identifying or empathizing with them?
Well, yes, I might not necessarily identify with them or what their behavior. However, I due to their circumstances, I probably can empathize with them.
Okay. Well, then
I also think, because you said something, Susan, about compassion and being judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
Do you not think that? Because so many people are, it seems like it's an easy thing to be judgmental, even though it's not necessarily a positive thing. Do you think that you can be a very compassionate person and yet still be a judgmental person?
I don't think so. It's not been my experience. I think you have to,
mm-hmm.
part of what compassion is about, and maybe we could focus on some examples in close relationships, part of what compassion is about is suspending judgment. It's really humanizing the person, recognizing that there but for fortune go you, that it's just a matter of circumstance or some kind of life situations, that that you recognize your common humanity. And I think that when you're judging someone, you're kind of marginalizing them. You're casting them out in a way. You're making them smaller. You're reducing them in some way. So I don't see how you can really be compassionate if you're in a very judgmental place. Now, I'm curious, would you, I'm wondering if either of you or both of you could share some examples of compassion in any relationship you've had, and how you feel it affected the relationship, either compassion you had for somebody else or compassion a key person had for you, and how it changed the relationship.
Well, speaking for myself, I think as I've gotten older and more mature, I've developed more compassion, and I've learned or tried to be less judgmental. I had a friend who, she carried on with married men, and
mm-hmm.
I was very young and innocent, and I broke up the friendship over that. However, I guess I was unable to put myself in her position or the relationships which she had experienced, and why she would. Why she would do such a thing, risk another person's relationship or not necessarily risk, but compromise,
mm-hmm.
put them in that position as well as herself. And as I've gotten older, I think maybe I might be able to put myself in that circumstance and forgive myself. I don't know if you saw Oprah the other night. Did you?
No. What did she? What was it about?
Well, she interviewed Paula Deen. You know who Paula Deen is?
The chef was diagnosed with diabetes,
She has a cooking show. She's very famous.
Yeah.
I'm sure everybody knows her. And Paula Deen confided in Oprah that she had a 10-year relationship. With a married man before she married the person she's with, and how she's had to learn to forgive herself
mm-hmm.
for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just all part of maturing and growing.
Right. It's a more open-hearted stance. And so she really needs to work on self-compassion around forgiving herself.
And as I said before, when I was 19, I broke up with my friend. And she was my best friend, actually. And I think today, if that had, you know, if that had happened, I might be more understanding and more empathetic and more forgiving.
Well, I think we don't see the world in such black and white terms as we get older. Things are not so either or, black or white. And I think we have lots of situations that really give us opportunities to connect with people and to really kind of psychologically walk with them. And, you know, so I think life gives us lots of opportunities to really develop it. How about you, Laura? Is there any situation that comes to mind for you where you have either experienced it or not?
No, I do. And actually, during this whole conversation, I've been thinking, I find it's not hard when you care about someone and if you're a sensitive person to feel compassionate to someone. But my question is there such a thing as, I don't know what the expression, what the terminology in your field would be, but when you feel that you are not overly compassionate, but when you are compassionate, exhausted, when you feel you have no more to give because you are so compassionate that I don't know if I know how to explain it.
It's called we call it compassion fatigue.
Fatigue.
Actually.
I think I may have heard that expression before.
Yes, and it's used. It's often used with in the context of caregivers, people who work in the caregiving field, or caregivers and families who, you know, are called on to be there and hold hands and to take care of somebody, and or it can happen just in a regular relationship, a marriage, or a relationship with someone. Where your experience is that you're listening to their sad stories a lot, and you're holding their hand psychologically, and you're providing support, and there's something that there's a point in time for a lot of people where something switches off, and you get it's like too much. And have you?
And then I would imagine you say to yourself, "Hey, what about me? Enough already."
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So we talk about this in my Buddhist practice a lot because I've had these issues with some friends. And then I feel, well, if you're compassionate, does that mean that you are a bottomless pit for someone? They can just keep pouring it in and pouring it in, you know, with the hold my hand and be there. And what I've learned is that you do have, you want to be compassionate, but there are certain limits, and you have to know how to limit your time with someone who you feel is a bottomless pit. Can
They can drain you.
Absolutely, but you know what?
They literally drain your life force.
They can, who was it? Martha Beck calls them squids, you know, where they suck the life out of you. But
vampires.
Being compassionate doesn't necessarily mean, you know, if you feel compassionate, it doesn't mean that you have to be available 24/7 to somebody. So I think you can be compassionate. You can feel compassion and also set appropriate limits around your availability to that person, especially if it's somebody who feels like they're a train wreck.
That's very hard to do. I find that. Do you have clients that share those feelings with you? It's very hard to know how to monitor your time because then I feel, and that could be my own personal issue, that I'm not being a good friend. I feel I don't know how to set the boundaries.
Yeah. It's a very central issue about. When and where does it direct you to certain actions, and when is it really just a state of your heart? And so that you don't feel such harshness towards somebody, and you don't transmit a feeling of judgment and harshness and blame. So that's a very good point you're bringing up, because just because you may feel compassionate towards somebody doesn't mean that you're available to them 24/7.
Right.
And, you know, that's true in friendships, and that's true in close relationships and in marriages.
Right.
Now, I have, there's actually a few exercises that are pretty well known in the therapy field to foster compassion. And I know this has been helpful to me at times when I feel very judgmental and I have very harsh feelings towards somebody and I feel like just shaking them and I don't feel some tender feelings about how they may be shooting themselves in the foot, especially if their behavior has in some way hurt me. And this comes up a lot around the issue of forgiveness. One very helpful exercise, and I wonder if the two of you have ever heard of this, is to spend a day imagining you're walking in your partner's shoes. Let's assume it's in a marriage or a very close partnership. To spend a day literally getting into their body and spend a day walking in their shoes. And I'm wondering, what have either of you heard of that?
No, I have not. That's interesting, though. That's interesting. What? And you've done this, and you recommend this to your clients?
Yes. It can be a very helpful thing because you really and it starts with just the physical.
Well, are they Gucci?
The what?
Are they Gucci? Are they Gucci shoes?
Well, it's easier if they're Gucci and very well designed for lots of walking. But let's say they're really crappy shoes. You know, it's literally starts with the experience of getting into their physicality and what is it like to be in their body and what do you see through their eyes? What are the sights, sounds, and smells? What do you feel? It's a very powerful exercise, and I think if all couples spent even just maybe 20 minutes once a week doing this exercise, I think it would really raise the tenderheartedness quotient between partners.
Well, what I can kind of, it may not be a good analogy, is I live in New York City, and of course, being in the city, we have so many. There's so many circumstances and situations where you can feel a lack of, you don't feel compassionate toward your fellow human being because there's just so many people here and people can be rude. But what helps me sometimes if I'm feeling angry towards someone who seems like they've been rude toward me, and this may not be a good example, but I'll stop and I'll say to myself, Laura, you don't know where they're coming from. They could have just received some bad news. So I try to put myself, not knowing them and not knowing where they're coming from or what's happening in their life. So that's, in some way, how it helps me when I stop myself. If I have a moment of feeling angry, if someone's not quite polite, I will stop myself saying, you don't know this person, and you have no idea what's going on in their life.
Well, you're kind of getting into, it's a little bit veering into the next exercise to develop compassion, and I'm going to share that with you. But, Laura, are you on speakerphone? Because there's an echo when you talk.
No, I'm not.
There's like a playback.
No,
are you talking far from the phone or what?
No, not at all. No, sorry.
Huh.
No.
Okay, you're on a cell phone, though?
Yes.
Okay, that may be the problem. What you're doing when you do that is a little bit like this next exercise, which is another very, very powerful exercise. And this is a really good one when somebody, particularly when somebody has violated you and in some way they've hurt you in some way, and you want to move towards releasing yourself from feelings of bitterness and victimization. You want to be able to forgive them. And that, by the way, does not necessarily mean that you reconcile with them. Okay, this is really more of an internal heart state that you're moving toward. You write a compassionate biography of this person. And as the backdrop or the context for an offense that they committed towards you. So you, for instance, you would think about what were their circumstances at the time they did this thing that felt violating. What were their early life experiences? How did they get to this point? And what were the underlying emotions that may have contributed to the offense. So it's kind of like when you say, you know, you try to think about, well, maybe somebody was having a bad day, and you're kind of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You're really imagining, well, what is the larger context for this? There's another part to this exercise, and I think this is, you would probably know more about this than I do, Laura, if you practice Buddhism. You give them an emotional gift. So it's like the prayer, may you be happy, may you be peaceful.
Yes.
You give them an emotional gift of some kind.
You wish them well. Yes, you wish them well.
Yeah, but it's not just a generic I wish you well. So it might be something very specific, like, you know, I am going to gift you, I'm going to hope for you that more people smile at you today, that you experience love today, something like that.
Right. That's interesting.
That is that, in fact, that's my understanding. That's part of Buddhist practice.
Yes, part of it. Part of it is a meditation similar to that, yes. And
okay.
It can be very powerful.
Yeah. It's very healing for the person who is bestowing it. It's really kind of establishing a whole different kind of understanding and tenderheartedness toward that person. Now,
definitely the other cheek.
What'd you say?
I said it's definitely not turning the other cheek.
No. No, it's and actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think of compassion as a kind of leaning in stance, and I talk about this a lot in my work with clients. It's leaning forward rather than pulling away when you're trying to understand another person and feel empathy and tenderheartedness for them. It's leaning in. Turning the other cheek is. You know, I think that there are times when we all have had to do that, but that's really turning away. And people need to do that at times just for their own sense of survival. But this is really leaning in and leaning forward. Now, in the interest of time, I'd like to go on to the next one. Did either of you have anything else you wanted to either ask or share about compassion?
No.
Before we move on to the other one?
No, that was great. You said some very interesting things that I'm going to practice.
Yeah, it's really easy practice. Just the one walking around in somebody else's body that's an amazingly powerful tool. And
how much,
you literally take yourself
how much
through
they
their,
weigh?
If they weigh a lot, you're in their body and you feel very heavy.
I'd like to be in a 5'8". 125 pounds.
Oh, well, you could, if you are working on compassion for somebody like that, then you find somebody who's 5'8".
In my Gucci's.
In your Gucci's, right. Absolutely right. Now, the next one is unity, okay? And in the dictionary, they say it's the state of being one or undivided. And I think this is a really particularly important stance in marriage and close partnerships, whether you're coupled up and, you know, through matrimony or not. But and I'm not, when I say unity, I don't mean you're joined at the hip and that you're symbiotic and that one parrots the other, but that I see it as a collaborative stance that reinforces partnership and the we. It's leaning into the we. So it might be how you share responsibility or labor in a situation. One person doesn't just leave it to the other. We tackle the plowing, or we tackle the cleaning out of the garage. We might have a division of labor, but we recognize that it's a we task. I also,
in a perfect world.
And what?
In a perfect world. And if you're not married to an Italian.
it's something to strive for. Do you not experience unity in, I take it you're married to an Italian, you don't experience unity in your marriage?
Not
or
necessarily.
Is there unity that maybe you're not recognizing? Maybe less obvious unity.
Okay, I'll hold on to that.
Okay. Well, let me give you some other examples of unity, okay? And maybe you'll find unity in a place that you hadn't been looking at, for it. So it might be how you share labor or a kind of collaborative stance around a situation. I think unity is important for protection against an outside threat to either partner. So let's say one person has a parent who's really toxic, and it's really important that the one partner doesn't leave their other partner out to dry. They don't throw them under the bus. They maintain a we stance whenever possible. And that doesn't mean you agree with your partner that right. everything they say or do, but you don't sacrifice your partner to somebody else, an outside influence that's a menace in some way. You stand together whenever you can. And that's really important as far as enforcing boundaries. And the obvious one is, I don't know if either of you have children, but at key times with children, so for instance, if you've had a fight and the kids are privy to it, they've heard you screaming, I think it's really important. Or if there's been an affair, I think it's really important to find a way to say to kids, to use we statements, we are not getting along, not your father is an ass and he's behaving
right.
really badly and that's why you heard me screaming. Very different stance.
It seems, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that in order to have a very unified kind of relationship and actually I was about to say fair, and I know that's one of the stances, that's the third stance I think you mentioned, unity, mm-hmm. fairness, and fun. It seems like it requires a certain amount of respect for your partner.
Yes. Well, it does, but my point is that these
loyalty.
Behaviors, loyalty, absolutely, but they require respect, but they also generate respect. Because let's say deep down in your heart, you feel respect for your partner, but you don't show it.
Right.
They're not going to feel respected, and it's not going to it's going to damage respect for you and
right.
for them.
I think if you feel it, you would show it.
People, not always. You know, you could feel a lot of respect for a spouse whom you think is a wonderful person and works really hard and has a good heart. But if you're a pleaser, for instance, let's say that spouse's mother calls and starts complaining about them, and you're a pleaser, and you want everybody to like you, and you don't like conflict, you could respect your spouse and throw them under the bus.
So what do you think, Susan, that it is required in a relationship to be? Because I think this is, as Marge said, in a perfect world, it's great, and I think it's very important to have a healthy relationship, to have a relationship of unity. But what do you think it really requires on the part of the partners?
What do you mean? What does it require?
Well, the people involved, what is it? Does it mean that you have to really, because you can love someone but not like them, you have to really like them? You have to understand their need for also being separate?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Boundaries?
Oh, absolutely. Unity doesn't mean that you're joined at the hip.
Right,
what
I'm, you said that, and I believe that. I agree with that.
It means that in key situations where collaboration is really called for, or protecting each other is called for, or standing together is called for, that you honor that you don't leave your partner hanging on the line out to dry all by themselves. I had a situation with two people I had a relationship with at one point. We were sort of three friends, and one of them would one of them would complain to me about the other one, and you know, the third friend would often do things that were repugnant. They just weren't very fair. There we go, the fairness.
Right.
And then when the person who did the not so nice things would show up and continue to do the not so nice things, I would speak up about it, and the other friend didn't maintain any unity with me. She would bag me, and she'd leave me. She'd throw me under the bus and let me out there all by myself to complain, and didn't stand with me around something that was obviously a shared complaint. And I remember it used to enrage me. And eventually I decided, you know what? This is not a healthy friendship for me, because it just went on and on and on, and it didn't change as I talked about it. So, you know, I think part of it is it's really looking at what are the situations that would call for you standing together. And Marge, I'm wondering, now that you think about it, even with your Italian husband, who sounds like he can be difficult, are there times, as you think about it, when you are appropriately a unified front and you do appreciate it?
Well, I guess it depends on whether or not he's had pasta that night.
So it's got
a very interesting caller there, I must say.
Yeah, really. She's never serious.
I think she must be a stand-up comic.
Absolutely. So it's kind of...
When push comes to shove, he's there for me.
Okay. And he's there with you. And I take it you...
There with me. Actually, I had an experience just this weekend, as a matter of fact. I own a watch business, and I do the selling, and my husband does the repairs. And I'm kind of like the go-between for my husband. In other words, people have to go through me before they get to him. And this one customer who we hadn't seen in a while didn't want to deal with me at all. She actually held her watch to her chest as if it was a $100,000 watch and said, I only want to talk to Joe. And I gently leaned over and I said, well, can you realize that what you just said might be hurtful to me because it's insinuating that you don't trust me.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happens that she happened to be a paisan. You know what I mean? She was she's Italian, as is my husband. I am not.
Mm-hmm.
And he dealt with her very gently. And I then overheard their conversation, and he was expounding on all my good qualities to her.
That's a demonstration.
So that made me feel very nice.
All right, so you must have had a lot of pasta that day. You must have given him some good pasta earlier in the day. But that's what I mean.
Or something else the night before.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever. It was predicated upon. But that's a good example of unity, where he stood with you. He didn't throw you under the bus and say to her, you know, anything that would indicate that it was okay for her to divide the two of you, that you're a team. You're a team, and he backed you.
Exactly.
And in my experience working with couples, that feels, that is such a trigger for people when they do not feel backed.
They don't feel validated.
It's not only not validated, people feel betrayed. Most of us, when we feel like we're out there on our own and someone has jumped ship and they really belong, they really should be standing with us, it's a profound experience of betrayal. You know, I know my husband, Tom, and I, at times in our rearing of our son, Alec, we'd agree on something Alec was doing that was asinine or just not okay. And I cannot tell you how, if I had a gun, I probably would have wanted to shoot Tom, because when it came to confronting Alec, he like disappeared. And that wasn't because he didn't respect me or he didn't love me. It's because he's a little conflict averse.
He wanted you to always be the bad guy.
Well, he didn't want me to be the bad guy. He couldn't stand conflict. So we've had to do a lot of talking and working about how do, you know, what does unity look like? And so when we're going to present something to the outside world that's at all difficult, we actually problem solve it. What's going to be your role and what's going to be my role? Because I'm not up for surprises where I'm out there by myself. And by the way, it often defaults to the person who is more assertive or who's more of a big mouth. Or just more comfortable with confrontation. Now, we have somebody else. No, I don't see. We have another 804 caller. If you want to join us, just press your one key. I'm not going to pull you onto the air and out you, but if you want to join us, feel free to press one on your phone, and you're welcome to join us on the air. We have an open mic session, and we're really in the thick of it talking about unity or lack of it. Now, do either of you have any examples of where in any key relationship there wasn't sufficient unity and it was pretty devastating?
Nothing that comes to mind just yet. But then again, I'm very good at blocking.
Okay. Blocking will help you in a way when you feel betrayed in this way. It'll have limited usefulness because eventually you have to face your feelings. But how about you, Laura? Any
I can't think of anything. The issues I've had in my relationship were not usually around unity or lack of unity.
Yeah. Right. Now you brought up something, Laura, that I think would be I think it would be important to kind of note that these, by the way. You both said it in your own way. You said, well, in a perfect world, these are stances to work on. I'm not saying that you have to be perfect in all these spheres in order to stay in your marriage or your partnership.
Right.
I think we're all works in progress, and these are attitudes and stances that require, I think, thoughtfulness. That's why I'm sharing these exercises with people. Intentionality. It requires a kind of consciousness. It's something always in the process of hopefully growing and getting better at.
Right. In Buddhism, we call, and you said it's thoughtfulness. It sounds like in some ways you've done some reading about Buddhism and meditation, Susan.
Oh, yeah.
We call it mindful. We call it mindfulness.
Oh, yeah.
Well, may I interject, caller?
Yeah.
Obviously, you're not as a devoted listener as I am, because Susan had a show on that two times ago.
Yep, and I think you joined us. Absolutely.
I'm sorry I missed that one. I didn't. I can probably listen to it on your. You have a thing where I can get back and listen to some of your past radio shows.
I'm glad you asked that. For anybody joining us now, if you need to get off and you want to listen to the rest of the show. If you go to, there's two things you could do. You could either go to blogtalkradio.com/Susan Lager. And there's a listing of all the recorded shows.
Oh, that's great.
All the shows are right there. Or you could go to my website, which is susanlager.com. And on my website, on the right column, there's what we call a web player. It's a little Blog Talk Radio player, and it has listings of the last, I think it's the last four shows. If you want to see all the old shows, I think today's the 19th show, actually. I can't believe it's been so many shows. Yeah, if you want to see all of them with the write-ups about all of them, you would just go to the blogtalkradio.com site.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Now, what about fairness? Fairness, if by the dictionary, is defined as freedom from bias, dishonesty, or injustice, even-handedness. That's how they define fairness. And I see it in my work with couples and with people just talking about relationships in general as you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So equal rules for both, equal expectations for both. Turn taking, so that when people lean into decisions, they lean into win-win decisions. It's, solutions are not one doing well at the expense of the other. That's not fair. That's not even-handed. And I see fairness as absolutely critical. And I think I've seen people get divorced over a lack of fairness because eventually they shut down and turn away from each other. I think fairness fosters respectfulness and is based on respectfulness. And I think it grows an experience of mutuality that, you know, it's there's reciprocity in the relationship. There's give and take. And I'm wondering how did the two of you see fairness playing out in any of your relationships or the lack of it?
Well, what comes to mind at the moment, does the clicker, the television clicker, does that play into this, you know, when one has control of the television clicker?
That's a major one. Does one get all their shows at the expense of the other? That's not fair.
That's an ongoing thing with me.
Okay. Now,
should I harbor resentment over that, or shall I? The other cheek?
Well, hopefully you would talk to him about it, that you want to join him watching TV, you want it to be enjoyable for you, and if it's all his preferences, it's not fair. That you would like to feel like you're more present for the experience also. And there are things you could do, by the way. It doesn't mean that on every night of watching TV that he has to watch your show and you have to watch his show. You might build in more even-handedness or fairness by, you know, maybe three nights a week we watch my show. The other three nights a week we watch your show. Or we draw straws. But ideally,
or we go into the other room and listen to Blog Talk Radio.
Well, sometimes that's the only solution that people feel like, and that's part of the problem, that people, they give up. They feel like, you know, there's no talking to my partner about this, and they take their marbles and they go home. And that,
right.
You see that in a pervasive way. It's not just in one situation, but if it's
right.
Pervasive in a relationship, that creates more and more distance and deeper resentments and more estrangement. That's not good for a relationship. Now, Laura, how about you with the issue of fairness? Have you experienced any lack of it in a relationship, or how do you see it?
Yes, I have. Not in the current one I'm in. Yes, I have. But, and forgive me for saying this, I think in relationships with men and women, there's always a double standard in favor of the man. I don't know if your clients talk about that. I imagine
yes, they do.
They complain about that.
Yes, at the end of the work day, both worked all day. Maybe the woman was at home working or child-rearing, and maybe the husband or vice versa. One was out, one was in. And at the end of the, quote, work day, one sits down and plops on the couch and watches TV while the
right.
other one is doing dishes and putting the kids
right.
to bed. It's
right.
a constant complaint. It's very pervasive.
I imagine.
And it's poison. It's poison in a relationship. And I really ride heavily on the partner who is happy with that. You know, that's they're happy, so why isn't my partner happy? Because what I say to people is that if any situation only works for one partner and not the other, it's not a good solution. Unless you have decided consciously and intentionally, we're going to do this because it's what you want. This is not what I want, but next time we'll do what I want. So, for instance, if one partner wants to get a dog and the other partner says, no, I'd rather get a guinea pig. Well, you can't make a compromise that necessarily feels fair, but you might say, well, this year we get the dog, next year we get the guinea pig. Or maybe we won't do the turn-taking around that. This time I get my way for where I want to go on vacation. Next time you get your way, if we can't agree on something that would feel like middle ground. But the most important thing is that you create even-handed situations where there's an experience of it works as well as possible for both of us. Now,
would
I have an exercise.
I'm sorry.
What? What'd you say?
I was going to ask, would you say that in your experience with your clients and talking about their relationships and the fairness or lack of, that in every relationship there's always one person that gives more, always one that loves more? It's never an even 50-50. We strive and we work toward that. But is any relationship where it's pretty fair even?
Well, you're talking about two different things. I think it's very common for one person to be more invested or show more caring or to cherish their partner more than the other one does. I see that with some frequency. But that that doesn't necessarily mean that there have to be grossly unfair situations at the heart of the relationship.
Right.
You know, somebody can have a sense of fairness. And maybe they can be fair towards somebody they sort of like just a little and fair towards somebody they love just a little. The fact that they don't love their partner quite as much doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily a predictor of built-in unfairness. There's other issues that come with that, but I think looking at your behavior. A lot of this is, what are the behaviors? How are you showing these things with behaviors? And I have a good, there are a few exercises that are really very simple. They're so self-evident, but often, you know, people look at me when I suggest them, like I've just invented the wheel. There's often an experience of unfairness around the division of labor. That's the major one in marriages. And people can't seem to agree about who's going to do, usually the less assertive person, often the wife, gets, you know, she just gets left with the nastier chores or the longer list of chores. And often is complaining about it, very resentful. Then she's not sleeping with her husband and he wonders, why aren't we having any sex? And so, you know, I spent a lot of time looking with partners at some of their underlying agreements like this. So with this one, I literally have invited people to make a list, each of them, make a list of all the daily and weekly chores. I call it the crap of life, the chores that go into the running of their life and their household. Everything from emptying the garbage to cleaning out the toilets to unloading the dishwasher, that kind of stuff. Picking the kids up at school if you have young children. Each make a list and then get together, combine your lists, and then each of you, you know, you make a list of a preferred chores and chores that you don't like so much, dreaded chores. And you take turns picking from the preferred list and the dreaded list. So each of you gets a preferred chore. And then the next time around, now you each pick a dreaded chore. And if you're left with a whole list of dreaded chores, you divide them up. And it's something that you can recycle and switch around so that nobody's perpetually cleaning out toilets or something like that.
Right.
Turn-taking is really important. But literally, looking at how can we divide the labor in a way that feels more equitable. The same thing is true for another one, is taking turns. If you're talking about fairness, very often this has come up a lot in my work where the weekends kind of default to what one person wants to do. And The other person feels, you know, they sort of give up. It's not their picture of an ideal weekend, and they at some point just stop talking, or they nag all the time. And I encourage clients to make lists of activities that are their ideal weekend type activity. What are the kinds of things they would really like to do? And they combine the lists so that each weekend, if you can arrange it, if you have enough time, it may have to be one weekend we do your thing, one weekend we do my thing, but each weekend you do at least some piece of what each person wants to do. That happens, people play that out on vacations. You wouldn't believe how many people go on vacations to these beautiful spots, and then they're fighting the whole time because they can't come to something that feels fair around this. Anyway, I'm looking at time, and we're kind of running out of it. The last one
that's
is fun.
Fair. That's
the
not
what?
Fair.
I know. That's not fair. Do you believe it's almost an hour? I was going to do a 45-minute.
Well, we didn't get fun. What about fun?
That's what we have to get to right now. It's fun. And the definition is something that provides mirth or amusement or enjoyment. And in my experience working with couples and in my own life, I think fun is not just something frivolous. I think fun, the capacity to have fun, is very important. It builds joy. It promotes bonding. I think it gives people perspective. When you have fun and it's not all work and drudgery and hashing out your disagreements, it gives you perspective about why you even bother, why you're invested in this relationship. I think it lightens things. I think it injects humor. It radically increases goodwill and motivation for problem solving. So I think fun, to me, is like the grease that greases, you know, the wheels of the mechanism. And do the two of you feel like you're having fun in your relationships?
Sometimes.
Yes, I enjoy. I do. So, I laugh a lot. And I think that laughter is important.
Yes, you're having
Without
fun.
Without laughter, everything else feels like it's canceled out.
Okay. When you're laughing, you're having fun.
Absolutely.
And Marge, it sounds like not as much for you.
No.
Then I would recommend that you use one of my exercises, which is to the two of you talk about things that are fun to each of you, and that you, instead of just doing the same old things, you do your fun things, he does his fun things, you establish a we zone. That gets to the unity also. A we zone of things that you explore together that would be fun. And chances are, Marge, if you think about it, you do some fun things together.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Well, we sailed across the country together.
Okay.
That was
that was fun, right?
Not many people could say they did that.
No. And just living in a sailboat, I would imagine, you had to be having some fun. You had
well,
to
when you weren't scared
so
to death, when you weren't scared out of your mind.
Right. But anyway, creating a fun zone in the relationship, you know, exploring activities that you explore together, you know, and it's really stretching. It's kind of going into a zone that may not be as familiar to either one of you. But I say to people, don't minimize the impact of fun. Unfortunately, we're going to shortchange fun, which is no fun, because we only have a minute left. I want to thank you, both of you, for being on the air with me and sharing in this discussion. I learned some things from you. I hope this, and I hope it was fun for you. I hope maybe you learned some things.
Great. Yeah, well, to encapsulate, it sounds like in order to work on all of these things that we discussed, one really, you have to be very aware of it. You have
yes.
to be very mindful.
Yes,
you always
absolutely.
Have to be mindful of being compassionate, of being fair, of having
yes.
fun.
Yeah.
So that was very helpful to me, actually.
Yeah. Mindful of all of these things, to not think of your relationship as just something that happens to you. Anyway, I do have to wrap up. Thank you very much, you listeners.
Thank you.
And anybody else who's been on the listened in, tune in to the next show, Wednesday, March 21st. I will have a guest and a topic to be announced. I haven't yet firmed up the guest, so I don't want to commit somebody who's, you know, she may not be able to make it, but I will be announcing it very soon, and it should be a very, very, trust me on this one, compelling topic. So it's Wednesday the 21st, and it's at 8:30 again. I'm into the new earlier hour, okay? So thank you very much, and I hope you to take some of these ideas back to your own partnerships and have fun with them, okay?
Thank you.
Will do.
Yes, thank you, Susan.
Okay,
bye.
Good night. Take care.
Always. Bye now.
Okay, bye-bye. The lady's going to cut us off any second. So good night, listeners. I'll see you next time around, and we will see you then. Take care.